Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast. I'm your host, Michael Jordan, and I appreciate you being here. It was an honor to sit down and interview Dr. Saifedean Ammous for this episode. Saifedean is the man who needs no introduction. You probably know his works like the Bitcoin Standard, the Fiat Standard, and Principles of Economics. He holds no punches in his opinions, and I loved having this conversation where we touched on Bitcoin, on economics, and his story and path into Austrian economics specifically. But we compare the different schools of thought in the world of macro, and I love this conversation. I think you're going to love it too. I hope you enjoy. Alrighty, everyone. Like I said in the intro, I've got Saifedean Ammous here. Saif, thank you so much for joining the Bitcoin Way podcast. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this conversation. I've been looking forward to it for a while. So wanted to start, we're going to get into Bitcoin. I want to spend a lot of time on Austrian economics. And as someone who has been interested in economics, but not like a real student of it, and traditionally taught a bit of Keynesian in college, and then onto sort of Chicago school, I want to draw the delineation, but could you talk sort of pre-Bitcoin, how did you get into economics and where did you go from, I guess, probably the Keynesian perspective into the Austrian perspective?
Well, I at university, I was an engineer because my father's a doctor, and the only two acceptable options were doctor and doctor. But he would sort of grudgingly accept the failure of being an engineer. So I went into engineering because I wasn't excited about medicine. I did not find it interesting. And I was good at math, and I was interested in cars when I was a teenager. So I just thought engineering was the natural thing for me. But while I was at university, I became more and more interested in economics and in the economic development. And I took a macroeconomics course at university, which I did very well in because, you know, for economists, for engineers, it's generally pretty straightforward to walk into an economics class and solve the problems very easily because it's ultimately math. I mean, it's a bunch of basic high school math with a bunch of stories laid on top of it to explain to you why these numbers somehow justify inflation, basically. And so if you're an engineer, you can get the math very quickly, but then how it relates to the real world remains a sticking point and you don't quite get it. And so I was curious about it. And then I decided when I graduated, I decided I didn't want to work as an engineer. I decided I wanted to get a graduate degree in economics. So I got a master's degree in economics at the London School of Economics. And then while I was doing that, I thought I might as well just go ahead and do a PhD. So I applied for a PhD program at Columbia University and I got in. And so it all was like a bit of a whirlwind. I just went from being an engineer to being a PhD student at Columbia. And I was still very curious about economics and I was still looking to learn more and more and more about economics. And I was constantly reading about this. But I was not quite sure I understood it. And there was always this feeling that, you know, I'm still new, I'm still young, I'm still a student. That's why it doesn't make sense. And then at some point, I'm going to be reading enough about this that it's going to make sense. And I thought this point would be my comprehensive exams. In the PhD program, you take a comprehensive exam at the end of your third year, where you design a reading list and a syllabus with a professor on a topic, and then he examines your command of that topic. And then if you pass that, then you get to write your PhD over the last 2 years. That was the basic idea. So I thought this would be the time because I compiled a massive reading list and I just kept going through all kinds of things and reading all kinds of things. And I passed the exam and I was quite impressed with the amount of things that I read. And yet things didn't quite make sense. And it still puzzled me. Why is this economics business not make any sense to me? But that was around the year 2007, and that was with the beginning of the financial crisis and the beginning of the recession. At that time, it wasn't a financial crisis yet. It became a financial crisis in 2008. So there was that going on, and that was awakening my curiosity. And through my reading, I came across the work of, I'd say, probably Karl Popper was the one who took me off the straight and narrow path of Keynesian indoctrination, because you start thinking about Popper's ideas of falsifiability and how we know things and how they apply to science and how they apply to economics. And you start becoming pretty skeptical. And then Popper takes you, introduces you to Hayek, and then you start reading Hayek. And then you're going down the rabbit hole. And then you meet Murray Rothbard and Ludwig von Mises, at which point you become one of the rabbits in the rabbit hole. And that's sort of the final end of the hole. So I came across their work at around 2008. 2007 is when I would say I discovered Hayek, probably Mises and Rothbard around 2008, roughly speaking. And then I just became hooked, and I still was doing my PhD. I had to finish my PhD in 2009, but I was just constantly captivated by this. And then it started creeping into my PhD, and then my PhD became a long Austrian diatribe on economics, on Austrian economics and the ideas of Austrian economics applied to the topic of biofuels, of all things, economic policy around biofuels and sustainable development and renewable energy and so on. And so during this time, this made me quite confused and quite, lost, because the PhD is telling me all kinds of things, and then the Austrians are telling me all kinds of things. And the Austrians make sense, but, you know, the PhD is going to give me a degree, and that's going to get me to get a job. So there was a conflict there. And it wasn't very fun, because I ended up getting into trouble with my PhD committee, and I had to. I was supposed to be graduating in 2009, but they weren't happy with the PhD, and they made me rewrite parts of it. And so then I redid a lot of it and defended it a year later, and I graduated a year later than I should have. But it all worked out fine in the end, because I still got my job that I was going to get. But instead of starting my job as a professor, I got the job as a lecturer in Lebanon. So I moved back to Lebanon. I taught at a university as a lecturer, finished my PhD, and then became a professor. And so it all worked out fine. And then when I graduated, I had relatively more time to sit and think about things that I found interesting, rather than thinking about what I needed to do for the job. I mean, I should have been publishing in mainstream economic journals. I just couldn't get myself to do it, because it wasn't interesting. It wasn't really easy to figure out what these people wanted. You had to take out everything that makes sense from everything you write in order to try and get it published. And I was just more interested in understanding the world as it is. So I was reading about Austrian economics throughout that whole period, 2009, 10, 11, 12. And I was considering starting a startup that allows people to use money, to use gold as money. It was effectively a Bitcoin, but instead of a decentralized digital money, it would have a centralized giant gold vault in Switzerland, and then people all over the world would be able to trade that gold and escape their local currency. But as I started thinking about doing this practically, and then we saw all the massive barriers that governments put toward making something like this happen, and that's when I started thinking more critically about why gold can't work and why it's not going to be easy to make gold work. And that's when Bitcoin comes along, and then it fits in perfectly with everything that I had been learning up until then.
Okay. Wow. So you had, was there an unwinding period for you, or did the Austrian philosophy just click and you realized the lies you'd been told, or was it a couple of years of sifting through what's reality? Because obviously, to your point, what you were taught previously wasn't really reflective of what you were seeing and experiencing in the world. But was there sort of head trash that came with years and years of Keynesian indoctrination?
I think it was, it started to make sense. And then you start uncovering the lies one at a time. And you're still uncovering lies 15 years later. It's just, there's so much lies out there in fiat world. And once you learn how to think, and once you take off the fiat blinders that make you think in a certain way, you start seeing and detecting them everywhere. And so you start seeing them in all kinds of things, not just in economics, but in science and in politics and in all kinds of different things. So I'd say, I mean, there was an element of a big shock. I remember probably the biggest mind-blowing moment for me. I remember that moment vividly, the exact moment when I was reading a paper by Marty Rothbard called The Austrian Theory of Money. And it's a brief paper. I think it's only about 20 pages or so. But it summarizes the Austrian perspective on money so well. And I really think Rothbard might be the best writer I've ever read in his ability to distill really complex ideas and deliver them very briefly. This was a great example because you could read hundreds of pages of Mises. And Mises is great, but as a writer, in terms of communicating ideas, Rothbard is just completely different level. So you'd read hundreds of pages of Mises, and Mises is extremely verbose, and he uses very precise and very sophisticated language, and he doesn't leave a corner unturned, if that's or a stone unturned, I forget the expression, but he doesn't leave anything out of his writing. He's just constantly exploring every single last detail, whereas Rothbard just gets you to the important things that you need to know and manages to make the case for them very well. And so I remember the most mind-blowing moment was the moment when he said, when I read about the idea that any supply of money is enough and that you don't need the supply of money to expand. I remember this so well. It was 2008, 2009, somewhere around that period, probably around the period that Bitcoin was invented. So this was probably around the Christmas break, because I remember that Christmas break, I was just at home doing a lot of reading. And it was probably around then, around the same exact time Bitcoin was invented, when this idea came to my mind. And I hadn't heard about Bitcoin yet, obviously. But this idea came to my mind, and it's just to realize that everything that we'd been learning from day one was all about how the money supply has to be increased. How do we increase it? All the institutions that are there in order to make sure that the money supply increases in the right way and not in the wrong way, and all the different viewpoints on how the money supply should be increasing. And then these guys come along and just tell you, actually, you don't need to increase the money supply. And of course, the logic is unassailable. You can't argue with it. It completely blows your mind. Clearly, the quantity of money does not matter. What matters is the purchasing power of money. And so you can keep packing more purchasing power of money into any quantity of money as long as it is divisible enough. And so therefore, you don't need to increase the amount of money. And the only reason that you might want to increase the amount of money is, to put it politely, redistribution. To put it slightly less politely, but more honestly, theft. The only reason the money supply has ever increased is theft. People want to steal your wealth. And the only reason they could possibly have for increasing your money supply is to steal your wealth. Everything you learn in macroeconomics is a bunch of bullshit propaganda to explain and justify theft.
Got it. So ironically, you were learning about money as a fixed monetary good at the time when the money printer was going burr, right in the great financial crisis. So I guess this is a question I had for you later then, but is Rothbard where you would, for someone who hasn't, because most of what I've learned about Austrian economics has been honestly through listening to you on podcasts and much of the content that you put out. In terms of reading, is Rothbard where you'd begin for someone who hasn't gone down that rabbit hole yet? And are there specific books or papers that you'd suggest?
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely say Rothbard. I think he's the best writer, as I was saying earlier, in terms of communicating complicated ideas. And he's really the inspiration for me. I always try and learn from him. It's so refreshing how he manages to get straight to the point and just focuses on the relevant point and summarizes all the important ideas in simple, plain English language. It's a very, very, very difficult skill, because the temptation, I guess one way of putting it is, once you start writing and you're in the position of, I am writing things that people will be reading, it's difficult to resist the temptation to just be a little overly verbose and to try and get into too many details that don't really matter to the reader. It's very tempting to get into writing for yourself, as in, I need to write in a way that proves that I am right and that they are wrong, that justifies what I'm saying, that covers all the bases, and to forget about the consumer, to forget about building a product that somebody wants to read so that they can understand this. I think Rothbard is the best when it comes to this. He's just peerless. Nobody comes close. So he's really the best place to start. And honestly, I mean, I love Mises. I love reading Mises. But for beginners, and for people who don't have a lot of time, it's not the easiest. Like I wouldn't in my good conscience want to recommend Human Action to somebody who's curious about Austrian economics, just because I'd imagine that it would turn them off. And I would say the same about Man, Economy, and State, which is Rothbard's book, but it's a textbook, and it's definitely not for beginners, I would say. Well, I mean, it is for beginners in a sense, but it is for beginners who want to study it very rigorously, rather than somebody who wants to understand how is this relevant to my life. I want to get on with my life. I don't want to be an economist. I don't want to read thousands of pages. I don't want to get into academic debates. I want to know how this affects my business, my life, my family, how to think about money, how to think about my finances. For that, there are definitely a lot of great Rothbard books. I think probably the best one to begin with would be, well, my favorite is the paper that I mentioned, Austrian Theory of Money. I think that's great. Another great one, which is also brief, and it's also written for a lay audience, and you can get a free copy shipped to you from the Mises Institute. They print these and they hand them out for free. It's a great book, brief, short little book with small pages, only 100 pages or so. And it's called What Has Government Done to Our Money? It's a great place to start. It really shows you the fiat scam in very simple terms. Doesn't get too complicated, doesn't get too moralizing, but just explains it to you. And then your eyes will see the world differently after that. I also really like his book on America's Great Depression. It's called America's Great Depression. It's a great, great book. I think that might be my favorite Rothbard book because it is such an incredibly well-researched book, incredibly well-written book, and also an incredibly controversial book in the sense that it just flies straight in the face of everything that everybody is taught about the Great Depression, about American history, in a way that is going to be completely blow your mind. And you know, the official story of the Great Depression is something that a kid like me had learned in my high school in Palestine, of all places. And everybody in the world learns this stuff, that there was the evil, greedy capitalist, and then FDR came and did the great the New Deal, and then the New Deal saved the world. And this story is just so ingrained into curricula all over the world, at universities, at schools, everywhere. And he just absolutely demolishes it. And you can't argue with it because he marshals so much evidence and he shows you what actually went on. And it's absolutely mind blowing. It's truly, truly remarkable. So I would definitely recommend that. Beyond that, let's see. There's also, I'd say as a beginner, there's also Henry Hazlitt is great for beginners. He wrote a great book called Economics in One Lesson, which is a great book to begin with. But it's a little bit more limited than Rothbard. So Hazlitt was more of a popular writer. He used to write in the New York Times. He used to write in newspapers. He was a very good communicator of economic ideas, but he didn't have quite the depth that Rothbard has. So you'll see that that one lesson keeps repeating a little too much in that book, whereas Rothbard can, in that space, he can squeeze in 50 different lessons in the same amount of space. Rothbard's Anatomy of the State is very good. If you want to understand his anarchism, I think that's great. And then he's got The Ethics of Liberty or For a New Liberty. Those are good if you want to understand libertarianism. And generally, I think a great way to go about it, a great way to go about life is whenever you're curious about something, just pick that thing up and Google Murray Rothbard and that thing and just see what comes out. He was so prolific. He wrote so many books, so many articles, and you will be surprised. Jazz, for instance, just Google Murray Rothbard and jazz, and you will be absolutely astonished at the very strong, very convincing opinions that he has on jazz, of all things. I did the same on Palestine. I Googled Murray Rothbard Palestine, and I came across an incredible article where he really, you could say it's one of the best things that has been written to explain what happened historically in Palestine, Israel. It's called War Guilt in the Middle East. by Murray Rothbard. It's an old article, but it works for pretty much everything. He was such a prolific writer that he's left so much to us. And there's something really amazing about it, because you look back at him when he was active, he was he was relatively obscure. He was an obscure university professor at an obscure university. He was in the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Wasn't exactly Harvard. And he wasn't exactly getting interviewed by the New York Times every week on his opinions on things. And so yet he was writing as if he was going to be read for 1,000 years. And I think that might well be the case, because here we are 25 years, 30 years after his death, and people are still reading his books. People read his books much more than they read any of his contemporaries. So think about all the mainstream economists that were active in the years where Rothbard was active. Think 1950 to 1990. Very, very, very few of these people are being read at all today. And those that are being read aren't being read nowhere near as much as Murray Rothbard. So I cannot recommend Rothbard enough. I think it's very well worth clearing your reading list for him and then spending a couple of months just going through all of these amazing PDFs. And you can get almost everything that he wrote. You can download it for free on the Mises Institute. Maybe everything, probably close to everything. But you can find it all on the Mises Institute, download it in PDF, or you can buy it on Amazon or eBay, relatively cheap. Of course, also buy my books. Don't forget, Rothbard's great, but also my books. I got to eat.
I think you're a very natural extension. And I think you write much better for probably a typical 21st century audience. The Bitcoin Standard, Fiat Standard, I think are very accessible in a way that someone writing in the 1970s or 80s is a bit more challenging. So I took, I think, 2 semesters of effectively Keynesian economics in college. 1 semester was microeconomics. I think that was probably what interested me most. I think I was most confused when it came to macro, probably for reasons you can imagine. I generally enjoyed the topic. I didn't have a lot of takeaways from it, obviously. And it wasn't until a few years later that I read Thomas Sowell for the first time. I'll be curious to hear your opinion, but I read his Basic Economics, and it was the first time so many of these sort of fundamental concepts made some sense to me, like how the world works. Thomas Sowell was the first time I heard anyone calling for the end of the Fed. I wasn't paying attention to Ron Paul. I was either too young or just disinterested. But I'm curious if you could maybe define for us the general Keynesian philosophy. And then, because I think Milton Friedman and a lot of folks who sort of came through the Chicago school, what their belief system effectively amounts to, and how those two are distinguished from traditional Austrian economics.
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's a long question. I could spend a lot of time. So if I get too rambly, or if I go off of too many tangents,
I think this is an important topic. This is an important topic, because I think the people who didn't learn Keynesian economics or maybe found sort of the Milton Friedmans, I think that is, to me at least, it feels like a step closer to an experience, the experience of reality that we have. And then Austrian, I think, seems to really tie a bow on the way the world really works. So it's an important one. Take your time.
Yeah. So from my perspective as an Austrian, the way that I see it, and of course the Keyneses are going to disagree, but they have all the universities and the newspapers and all the rest of the world for you to go and get their perspective if you want. I'm not, they don't ask me to go share my perspective in their textbooks, so I'm not going to try and sugarcoat this. But the way that I see it is Austrian economics is just economics. It's the continuation of thousands of year old tradition that goes back to Plato and Aristotle. It passes through Arab philosophers, and it passes through the scholastics in Spain in the, 15th, 17th century, something like that. And then the Renaissance, and Cantillon was a very important economist in Ireland, and then Adam Smith, and the old Austrian school then came about. There was also the Swedish school that was very important at the turn of the 20th century, the beginning of the 20th century. And there was the British school. And those were the three main schools in Europe of economics. And of course, there was the French school, which was generally older. So there was Bastiat and Say, Jean-Baptiste Say. So from this tradition, I think you could see that all of these are kind of one tradition, which is economics, which is people trying to think about how humans make decisions in the context of scarcity. Then the 20th century comes along and economics gets hijacked by a bunch of illiterate thieves called the Keynesians. And I said I'm not going to sugarcoat this, so this is how I see it.
No need to.
Ultimately, what this ideology was all about was just, in my mind, justifications for government theft. Government was going to be robbing people, and the way that they were going to be doing it was through inflation, and the Keynesians came about and gave the justification for inflation. That's essentially how I see it. So historically, of course, inflationist ideas had always existed. There's always been idiots thinking, well, they're not very stupid, realistically. It works out very well for them, usually. There's always been con artists who come up with the idea that, hey, we can make more money by increasing the amount of money, and then we'll just have more money. And if we have more money, then it's great. But then you remember that money is not about the quantity. It's not a good where you get more by having more. So that's why you prefer to have $1 over 10 Japanese yen. If I gave you the choice, you'll choose $1, even though it's only one, over 10 yens, which is 10. This is something that blows the mind of the average Keynesian, because in their mind, people just like bigger numbers. And so people should like 10 yens over $1, according to their idiotic, nonsensical logic. But according to human logic, with people who have active gray matter between their ears, we can see that it doesn't matter. If you add more money, you're not enhancing the function of money. You're not making money better. You're just redistributing the purchasing power from the people who had the old money to the people who just got the new money. And so that really is the main driver of what I would call non-Austrian economics. This is the original sin. The original sin is that this is a bunch of garbage that is being invented in order to arrive at that conclusion. And that immediately is shows you why you can discount it out of hand. And you don't really have to spend a lot of time on it. Well, I mean, you have to spend a lot of time to figure out that this is going on. But once you understand that this is going on, yeah, they're just trying to justify inflation. Then you see that this is a very unscientific and a very pseudoscientific way of trying to arrive at knowledge, which is, here's the conclusion. Let's see how we can do the methodology so that we can arrive at this conclusion. And that's effectively how I see it. So the main differences between the Austrians, I think the actionable difference in terms of the implication is the most important one, is the difference in the treatment of money. So for the Austrians, money is a good that emerges on the market. People like apples and oranges and homes and cars and shoes and clothes. And they also like money. And just like all of those things emerge on the market freely, money emerges on the market freely. And the Austrians have done a great job of explaining how money comes along into the market. Now, there's always been the statist view of people who are getting paid by the government from money printed by the government in order to justify more money printing by the government, or more coin clipping by the government, or more putting base metals into the coins in order to make more coins by the government. This has always been there. So what we can call the state theory of money, or chartalism, had always been there. And it formed the basis of what came to be mainstream economics in the 20th century. So these ideas are old. There's nothing new about them. Inflationists have existed since the days of the Roman Empire, and probably even before then. So there's nothing really new about any of that stuff. It's just that it got into power in the 20th century and destroyed real economics, because real economics was arriving at very inconvenient conclusions. So in terms of conclusion, the most important thing is whether the money should be something that the government controls, or whether it should be something that is out for the market for people to control. And that is the main question. But in terms of methodology, I would say there are two major differences, the way that I would identify them. The first and most important one is that Austrian economics, and I believe economics, is a subjective science. It's a method of understanding that is based on the basic idea, the basic building block, that value is subjective. Value exists in the minds of people. People make valuation in their own minds, and that valuation is ordinal and not cardinal, which means that we are able to value things compared to one another. We are able to decide that I prefer this thing over that thing. But it's not cardinal in the sense of you can put a valuation, a number on things, and then compare it to other things, because valuation is constantly changing, and because valuation is something that cannot be measured. And I think this is really the key point, which I emphasize in my third book, Principles of Economics. And I don't think people emphasize it enough, but this is, as somebody who has an engineering background, this for me is the precise engineering answer to the question of why subjective value in economics. And that is because there is no unit with which you can measure value, just like you can measure length or speed or time or temperature with precise scientific units. So the reason your laptop works is because everybody involved in the process of producing the laptop, transporting the laptop, producing the parts that went into the laptop, and shipping the laptop to your local supermarket, and then you picking it up from that supermarket and putting it home, everybody involved has a very precise and exact understanding of what an inch is, and what a meter is, and what a centimeter is, and what a kilogram is. And that's what allows the company that makes your laptop to buy the right parts. You know, they tell their people, we need the microchips to be 17 millimeters long, and then they make them exactly 17 millimeters long. You know, the fact that they have this thing called the millimeter or the meter, and that everybody agrees upon it, is what allows for all kinds of all kinds of scientific calculation and precise measurement in the natural sciences. We don't have something like that for value. We cannot express values in terms of a constant. And you'll notice this if you remember your macro or micro textbook, actually, in the micro textbook, you'll remember that when they try and measure utility, they're measuring utility, and sometimes there's no unit. And you ask, and that's when I would do this. I remember it was always the engineers who asked the best questions in my classes. There'd be an engineer who says, sir, what is that unit? And in the book, they answer that by saying, well, we call the unit a util. The utility is measured with utils. Okay, so what's a util? And how many utils do I need in order to get a sandwich? How many utils can I convert into a Ferrari? And how is this util thing calculated? And what's, you know, what, how many utils are there in my sandwich? And how many utils are there in my steak? There is no definition of a util. Nobody knows what it is. It's just something that they add into the textbook so that they can add numbers and equations and give you multiple choice exam questions so that they'd have something to test you about, other than just the propaganda that is the real point of the course. But so because we don't have a unit, we don't have a constant with which we can measure those things, it then becomes impossible to figure out how to perform economic calculation with valuation. And therefore, we cannot establish economic calculation with constants like we can with scientific units. And that's why we cannot produce the same level of precision and the same level of predictability in the science, in economics, that we can with sciences. And so in Principles of Economics, I go through this in detail. I give an example of how in chemistry, we use something called the ideal gas law. And the ideal gas law is something that somebody had come up with a couple of centuries ago. It's a formula that says PV equals to NRT. It's a clear definition of pressure, and there's a clear unit with which you measure the pressure. That's P. V is the volume. N is the number of moles. R is the Avogadro constant. And T is the temperature. Every single one of these has its own unit. And everybody who's involved in this business understands what those things are. Well, you measure the temperature with Kelvin. You measure the pressure with bars or pascals. You measure the volume with centimeters cubed or meters cubed or whatever. But so you plug this into this equation, And it allows us to perform this miraculous thing where you're able to figure out what the pressure of this container is going to be before you measure it, just because you know what the volume is and you know what the temperature is and you know the constants N and R. So you plug in the volume and the temperature and you get the pressure. And then you measure the pressure and lo and behold, magically, it gives you the same exact value that you had predicted from your formula. You cannot do that with economics. You cannot say, well, we have all of these factors and all of that leads us to conclude that next year we're going to have a GDP growth rate of 2.783%, or we're going to have an inflation rate of this or that, or we're going to have economic production increase by this percentage, or industrial output is going to increase by this or that. With all of these aggregate phenomena in macroeconomics, you don't get to treat them with scientific precision. And you'd never be able to do that as long as you don't have a unit. Because if you don't have a unit, you wouldn't be able to do it with gases. You would have no chance of figuring out what the pressure of that container is unless you had already defined all the units involved. So if you don't have that in economics, that puts, in my mind and in the mind of Mises, that just stops economics from being able to have quantitative predictions. You can't have quantitative predictions in economics in the same way that you can with the natural sciences.
So would you say that besides obviously seeking to justify inflationary theft, would you say that the Keynesians are, they've been in a constant search for a measuring stick where none exists, and the Austrians are comfortable with that in just evaluating human action versus trying to come up with, you know, a made up measurement or a made up unit that they can plug into their equations to make things make sense?
Absolutely. I guess and another way of thinking of it similarly or building on that is that from the Austrian perspective, you realize that the measuring stick is the human being himself. Hmm. And that is the foundation of all of this inexplicable. If you don't really understand Austrian economics, you don't quite get it. Why are all these Austrians libertarians? It's because you are the measuring stick. So you are the one who's able to make the valuation. You are the only one who's able to decide whether you like this laptop or you like that car, or whether you want to get a slightly worse car in order to get a better laptop. You're the only one who can make those trade-offs. You're the only one who could decide whether you can sell your car so you can buy a cheaper car so you can pay for your mother's operation. All of these things, if there is a measuring stick for it, it is you, your mind, and your valuation. And there is no possibility for somebody to be able to come and figure out the objective valuation of all of those things and then make the decision on your behalf and tell you, I've looked at you and I've looked at the things that you like and I've decided that you will be better off if you buy this laptop rather than that one, or sell this laptop and buy a new car or sell the car. You cannot make those decisions for somebody else because the inputs into that decision are all about subjective valuation, and the subjective valuation is in the mind of the person at the time and the place when they are making the valuation decisions. So yeah. For the Austrians, you accept that and then you understand what it is and then you try and understand the implications of it. For the Keynesians, it's the five-year-old tantrum theory of approach to science, which is, okay, well, we can't do that, but we're just going to pretend that we can, and we're going to keep pounding our hands and our feet on the ground until the adults let us do it. And that's basically how it functions, in the sense that, okay, well, we don't have a unit, but we're just going to assume that we have one and we're going to go ahead and do calculations. And then lo and behold, we arrive at the conclusion that the people who pay us want to hear, which is we should print more money. And so the point is to give it the scientific veneer. You know, it's not an innocent mistake. It's not like, oh, these people just need to read Mises and then they'll stop. It's not something that you can convince them of. It's not something that you can argue with them about because their paycheck depends upon it. So it's not a very innocent mistake. You see this so often. People's entire intellectual mind gets wrapped into their paycheck and their ego. And it builds this gigantic complex inside their mind where everything has to fit in with this giant complex the way that I see it. And then they become extremely hostile to anything that challenges this. You see it with Bitcoin. And the basic example, think about somebody like Rubini. All of his life, he's being paid to say that we need to print more money in order to fix the economy and the government should print more money, and that's how he gets paid. That's how he eats. That's how he puts food on his table every night. That's how he has a career. That's why he has a job. That's why he gets interviewed by the newspapers. That's why he gets treated like he's some sort of intellectual. And it's all tied in with his paycheck and with his intellectual belief in this idea. So then you come and you tell him, actually, no, we don't need any of that stuff. We're just going to get Bitcoin. You start getting Bitcoin derangement syndrome. And the same thing happens with mainstream economists when you try and explain to them that, look, very happy for you for all of your equations, but if you don't have a unit, all of your equations are just a bunch of nonsense. It's like you're a three-year-old playing with the numbers that their dad got them. You don't quite understand what those things do. Like, yeah, you've got all these little the toy numbers that my kids have. My two-year-old plays with those things, but she doesn't understand the difference between one and five. She's just moving them around. And that's kind of what the Keynesians are doing. And it's not valid. As long as you don't have units, then you're not measuring anything, and there's nothing valid going on there. So this is how I would say, and that's not specifically the Keynesians. I would say this is really mainstream economics post the 1930s. I mean, it amplified after World War I. The key thing to remember, of course, for the Keynesians, they'll tell you that we went off the gold standard in the 1930s because the gold standard caused the Great Depression, which is just another silly lie. They went off the gold standard in World War I. That's when, you know, Britain and European countries went off in 1914. The U.S. went off in 1917. And the crisis of the Great Depression happened precisely because they went off the gold standard because of all the horrible things they did between 1915 and 1929. And that's why I highly recommend reading Rothbard's book, America's Great Depression, because it will absolutely blow your mind when you understand this. And if you're an American, it's going to make you very, very, very angry about the British. If you hate the British and you haven't read America's Great Depression, I regret to inform you that you don't hate the British enough. You're going to hate them a lot more when you realize that the Great Depression, this is just such an incredible part of the book, the most important perhaps. The Great Depression happened because the British were in too deep with their inflation, and they were losing all of their gold because everybody was taking gold out of Britain and sending it to the U.S. because the U.S. had less inflation. And so the British central bankers basically scammed the American central bankers, who were a bunch of idiots, really, and just a bunch of hicks who got taken for a ride by the smart London bankers, and convinced them that the way to fix the world economy is for the U.S. to destroy its economy with inflation, because then if you guys are having inflation, we have inflation, and the Germans have inflation, then we can continue with our inflation and British people won't be able to run away with their wealth by sending it to the U.S. And so that's what created the depression in the U.S. So all of this aside is to go back to the original point on the economics, which is that, and this is a really extremely important point, it isn't as if a Keynesian came up with the idea of Keynesian economics in, say, 1931 or 1915 or 1912 and said, hey, you guys, I figured out this gold thing doesn't work. It's a much better thing for us to have money as being a slavery coupon for the government. And that's going to make life much better. And then, you know, he went on radio and newspapers and universities and convinced people with it. And then there was a vote and people decided to go off the gold standard and go on the fiat standard. This never happened. They went off the fiat. They went off the gold standard, went on the fiat standard. And then the Keynesians tried to come up with ways to rationalize this. So this was not a scientific conclusion that people had arrived at through any genius. It was to justify the thing that had already happened and the thing that had specifically happened under false pretense. So when they went off the gold standard, there was not a single person anywhere who said, we are going off the gold standard and it's a good thing. Everybody who wanted to go off the gold standard said, we're only doing this. We're not really going off the gold standard. We're just suspending redemption now because of war. But don't worry, the gold standard is still intact. And then when the war ended, oh, yeah, well, you know, we can't have redemption because of blah, 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 stupid reasons. But we're still going to go back on the gold standard. The gold standard is so important. It's the most important thing. And then they went on back to the gold standard, but they weren't nominally went back on the gold standard, but they didn't. I explained this in detail in the fiat standard. which gets into this in detail. So they went to something called the gold bullion standard, which is a scam compared to the gold standard, really. And they went to something called the gold exchange standard, and they did all kinds of different things. And then when they kept on, you know, 15 years after destroying the gold standard, they realize, oh, well, we've created a catastrophe. Better blame the gold standard and then get off the gold standard officially. So only after 15 years of lying and saying, no, the gold standard's great, we're going to go back on the gold standard, and we're just having to do this because of reasons, then they just, oh, no, actually, you know what? We should kill the gold standard. We should get off of it. And so the narrative that survives until today is that the gold standard was what caused the depression. And this is completely nonsensical. And anybody who thinks that is not a serious person. And I know that that basically includes 99% of econ PhDs. Yes, they're not serious people. If you think the gold standard caused the Great Depression, you are a joke. You do not understand anything about history. You don't understand about anything about money. And if anybody listening has a university professor who thinks that, I urge you to just ask them straight face, just say, okay, how did the gold standard cause the Great Depression? Walk me through the process. And then tell them, well, didn't they go off the gold standard in 1914? Didn't they suspend redemption? How was it the gold standard back then? And weren't they increasing the money supply? And you can look at the statistics from the Great Depression, America's Great Depression, from Rothbard. So by the 1930s, two things happen. They go off the gold standard officially. So now the government has a ton of money. And of course, that creates a catastrophe in the economy because the parasites are thriving at the expense of society. And one of the many breeds of parasite that start to proliferate because of the money printer is the modern economist, because now the government can pay people to tell it what to do with all the money that it prints. And now government needs to pay people to tell the world that, oh, it's actually a good thing for us that the government is printing all of that money. And so that's when you get, in my mind, modern economics. That was Keynes's book, The General Theory, and it was Irving Fisher's math, and that was wrapped into what you could say is the kind of neoclassical consensus of the post-war era with the work of Paul Samuelson, who kind of wrote the textbook on it. And with that, you get this kind of world in which we have these people acting as economists. Now, the main ideas, as I remember that I said, is government control of money and objective calculation of economic valuation. Those are the two things that, for me, define the pseudo-economics that is dominant in the 20th century. So all of this was just trying to talk about the mainstream and the Austrians. Now that brings in the Chicago people. Well, the Chicago people are an interesting breed. The Keynesians think of them as being no different from the Austrians, but we as Austrians think of them as being no different from the Keynesians. And, you know, they don't think of that because from my experience, most people who would consider themselves Chicago economists have never bothered to read the Austrians because they think, oh, well, these guys, they don't even know math. And so there's no point in reading them. And the reason I think the Chicago school was basically Keynesians, and I mean that as an insult. There is no higher insult I could give to somebody than calling them a Keynesian. The reason that I would call them a Keynesians is because they accept the fundamental premises. They accept the idea that A, we can perform objective economic calculation without a unit of calculation, because we just have all these computers and numbers and calculators, so then we can do it, just like my daughter thinks she's doing math if she's running around with the numbers and playing with them. Same kind of logic. Doesn't matter if we don't have units, we can just, if we make our papers look like physics papers, then we can pretend to be as accurate as the physicists. So methodologically, they are indistinguishable from the mainstream. Where they differ from the mainstream is in their conclusions. They arrive at conclusions that are more pro-free markets than the regular mainstream economist, which, to their credit, that is the part that I respect. But I don't agree with the methodology by which they arrive at. And this is why it's a manifestation of how silly this mathematics is, because you don't have physicists disagreeing or mathematicians disagreeing about the solutions for mathematical problems. There's no school of thought in economics that says 1 + 1 = 3, and then another school of thought that says 2. If it's numbers, it's math. You can show it, you can show the proof, and anybody who understands math will know that there's a right answer and there's a wrong answer. Well, we don't have that in macro. We don't have that in economics. And the reason is because of the fact that the methodology is broken. So therefore, you can use mathematical economics to prove anything and its opposite. And that's what we occasionally have. That's what's always happening. So with mathematical economics, we have papers that say minimum wage raises wages. We have papers that say minimum wage causes unemployment. We have papers that say everything. You can always split the data around in order to come up with whatever solution you want for this, because ultimately it's all about how you use the numbers and how you use the data, and it's about the theory that it informs it. So their pro-free market ideas, I mean, I agree with them as a conclusion, but I don't agree with the methodology that they use to arrive at them. And then the second and most important reason for why I would lump them in with the Keynesians is because they believe in government control of money. And so if you believe in government control of money, then A, you're allowed to be part of the mainstream. That's why people from Chicago can get jobs in the Fed and they can get funded in universities and they can be part of that, because, you know, you can disagree about everything you want. You can have all kinds of edgy ideas. But if you challenge the central banker's monopoly on the money printer, your career is over in economics. There's no way back. And this is true everywhere. There's a central bank. The central bank wants to print money. Your central bank is what pays for the research that takes place in monetary economics. Something like 80% or 90% of all the papers published in monetary economics have some part of the Federal Reserve involved in them. One of the co-authors is funded by the Federal Reserve or works at an institution that's funded by the Federal Reserve. So that means all of the important authors, all the important journals, all the important economics departments, it's all the Fed. And if you are not on board with the Fed printing money, that's it. You're not an economist anymore. So the Chicago people are sellouts on that. They accept that premise. They don't challenge the legitimacy of a central bank. And then they just try and use mathematical economics to arrive at the more free market solution for these market problems. But I don't believe that that is mathematically or methodologically valid, because the numbers don't really matter. The numbers don't really count for anything as long as you don't have units. And so you could lump them in with the Keynesians. But it's worth saying the real role that they play, I think the most important role that these the Chicago people play, is that basically they're the battered wives of the Keynesians, in that they need this scarecrow, this straw man of, look at all of these evil free market people like Milton Friedman. This is what evil is like. And if we don't get to have more government control, then all these evil capitalists would take over. And so this is why Milton Friedman is portrayed as this devil incarnate. When realistically, I mean, even if I don't necessarily like a lot of his work or agree with him, there's no way you could compare him to compare the damage that his ideas have done compared to what the damage of the regular Keynesians or the leftist socialist economists that have done a lot of damage. I mean, a lot of the high-profile economists that get treated as heroes have great relationships with all kinds of horrific totalitarian regimes all over the world, which are completely okay and completely justified, because, you know, as long as you're pushing for more government control, more money printing, then everything that you're doing is fine. And you're not responsible for the actions of any bad person associated with you. So there's no amount of horrible things that can be committed by any Keynesian government in the world that will ever reflect badly on the mainstream economists that advise these governments. Whereas every single person who will ever bring up any idea that has anything to do with free markets is always immediately, and you'll see this with the NPCs, they're programmed to do this. It's quite amazing. It never fails. If you go to somebody who doesn't understand economics and you bring up an idea about free markets, they will immediately, they are conditioned like Pavlov's dogs, they're conditioned to bark at you with Pinochet. oh, you're into free markets? That means you're into committing the crimes of Pinochet. You are responsible for the crimes of Pinochet. You are part of it because somebody in the University of Chicago at some point had something to do with Pinochet, and Pinochet killed some people. So therefore, every free market idea is now Pinochet. And so if you want to say not raise the minimum wage because you think that's going to lead to more unemployment, that means you're a mass murderer like Pinochet. And of course, the opposite doesn't apply. You know, all of the mass murder and death that was carried out by Keynesians like FDR or Churchill, that doesn't discredit the fact that all of these mass murderers in the 20th century had a money printer installed for them by some Keynesians who convinced them of Keynesian ideas. Doesn't matter. Guilt by association only works when you are opposing the money printer.
Hey, just a quick break and we'll get back to the show, but I want to introduce you to our very first sponsor of the Bitcoin Way podcast, Satoshi Coffee Company. Satoshi Coffee, sats.coffee is the URL. They make high quality, fresh roasted coffee, and they even put the block number to show proof of work on each bag. If you're watching on YouTube, you can see that. I'm not a coffee snob, but I'm sort of picky about what I do enjoy. And this Satoshi blend, which is one of their more popular blends, is incredible. They also have a blend from El Salvador and a couple of others. I'd highly recommend you trying out all of them. But the cool thing about Satoshi Coffee Company is they are Bitcoin only and only accept Bitcoin as payment. And as a Bitcoin Way podcast listener, you get 6.9% off if you go to sats.coffee and enter code TBW69. Again, Satoshi Coffee Company, sats.coffee. Check them out. Support Bitcoin only companies like Satoshi Coffee Company. Yeah. So I think what you hit on something, I think what drew me to the Chicago school was, I think, first of all, some of what they said was maybe made a lot more sense than the Keynesians, but probably just the notion of free markets, which is something I've always believed in. The delta then, and maybe this is why, like, going back as I would listen to you and then hearing clips from Thomas Sowell talk about ending the Fed, it was like I began to piece these things together. Like, yes, free markets, but yeah, like, why would we want the Federal Reserve having a monopoly on perhaps the most important market of money? And why wouldn't we send that back to the people? So I think that's a great explanation. If we could maybe shift gears for a minute, so you probably remember one of our co-founders at the Bitcoin Way, Tony, was in Lebanon when the currency collapsed. I know you have some experience in Lebanon. I don't know if you were there at that time, but maybe could you share a little bit about your experience in Lebanon and to what extent maybe that helped either shape your worldview on some of these topics, or at least bring to light the truth that you have discovered in Austrian economics?
Well, I mean, that's, I'm not sure. Do you want me to discuss Lebanon in particular, the situation of how things unfolded in Lebanon?
Yeah. Were you there during the currency collapse, or were you already?
I left Lebanon just a few months before everything went downhill. So when I left, the currency was still fixed. By the time I cashed out my retirement account from the university, because I quit my job at the university, by the time I cashed out my retirement account, I got a 40% haircut on it. But, you know, fortunately, I had Bitcoin, so that wasn't a huge disaster. But
what happened in Lebanon that... that was like, what was the systemic break that caused the collapse in Lebanon, and how does that maybe tie in with this Keynesian philosophical worldview?
I think the obviously the situation of Lebanon is very unique, just like everywhere else. Everywhere is unique. Everyone's got their own drama. Everyone's got their own conditions, and everybody likes to think of themselves as being special. And so people in Lebanon don't like it when I say this, because they really think that it's all about their own particular conditions. You know, it's because of Lebanon, it's because of the corruption, it's because of the militias, it's because of the religious sectarianism, it's because of this and this and that. And of course, all of those things are true. All of those things do contribute to the problems taking place. But in my mind, these are all the symptoms of the problem. The fact that these problems can result in the destruction of the currency is not caused by the problems themselves. It's caused by the fact that the monetary system is so dysfunctional, so as to make it vulnerable to these kinds of things. And that's what would not happen if you had a decent money like Bitcoin, which was not designed to rob you, whereas government money is designed to rob you. So I think this is what it ultimately comes down to. The modern central bank is an institution for taking purchasing power away from the people of the country and giving it to the government and the banks and their cronies. It's not a nice thing to say, but that, I believe, is the reality. And I believe it's the reality all over the world. It's not just unique to Lebanon. And this is a very, very, very problematic reality because it's quite sustainable as a dynamic. Because, okay, you would think, well, the people that are benefiting are going to be robbing the people that are robbed. So then the people that are robbed are going to get angry, and then they're going to rise up, and then they're going to lynch the people robbing them, and then they will live happily ever after with hard money and banks that work. It's surprisingly a lot more complicated than that. And the scam is a lot more sustainable because the scam is designed in a way that is sustainable because the money that the government can print allows it to shape public opinion. It can pay intellectuals, it can pay universities, it can pay school teachers, it can pay newspapers, and it can control those people, whether it's through the government directly or whether through the cronies who benefit from the government paying out of their own pockets from the money that they rob from the government and from the money printer. But ultimately, you're able to sell people on the idea that them getting robbed is for their own good. And that's really the ultimate scam. And so people get into this. And of course, that all comes down to the fact that they have a monopoly. So the way that the scam works is the government guarantees the monopoly of the banking system. The banks become an oligopoly. You know, a few families control the big banks and they have a monopoly. They have a Federal Reserve in the US. You know, it's a privately owned institution that's owned by the banks. So the government enforces that monopoly, prevents somebody from setting up a bank that competes with it. You can't just go and set up a bank in the US and say, you know what? I don't want to deal with the Federal Reserve. I don't want to deal with dollars. I want to set up a bank that doesn't deal with any of that stuff, and I don't want to have to deal with any of the regulation stuff. If you do that, you go to jail. In the US, pretty much everywhere in the world, you can't just set up a bank outside of the central banking cartel. That's what it functionally works as. Of course, it's marketed with all of these idiotic justifications like, we can't let people make their own banks because then what if they rob people, or what if they destroy their money, or what if they steal this or that? And of course, that makes no sense because it's the government that is doing the robbing. It's the government that is using the fear of one bank robbing you in order to justify creating a cartel. And for me, the answer is, I can't guarantee that all the banks are always going to be honest. And that's precisely why I want to have the freedom to open a bank and to go into whatever bank I want. Precisely so that if I run into somebody that is doing something bad with their money, that I don't have to deal with them. But that's, of course, what fiat does to you. Fiat central banking forces you to deal with the cartel that is in your country. And then when things go bad, you have no choice but to get screwed by them. Your money is what's going to lose value. Your savings are going to be devalued when the currency collapses. So the way that it works is that as long as there is a monopoly on the banking system, the government protects the bank's monopolies, and in return, the banks buy the government's bonds. Or in other words, they lend money to the government. So why are the banks buying the bonds? What's in it for them? What's in it for them is that the government tells them, protects their monopoly. And so by buying their bonds, effectively the government is, the central bank, is using all of society's savings, because the central bank has the reserves of all of society. And the central bank is using society's savings as collateral, and it's borrowing against it in order to, and it's using it to lend money to the government. And so if the government can't pay the money back, then it's the collateral that's going to decline in value. It's the people's savings that are going to be destroyed in value. And so this can continue to work. This scam can continue to work for a long time as long as the money continues to hold on to its value. And generally, you know, you can run it quite sustainably where the banks can make money, the government can spend money irresponsibly, and the whole thing can run for decades before it collapses. And so in Lebanon, this has always been the case. People were always, from the 1990s, people were saying the debt was unsustainable. And anybody looks at it, Lebanon is a tiny little country, had an enormous debt, and it had it has no real, as a government, it has no real major sources of income that can cover that debt. They get money from remittances from abroad, and they have a monopoly on cell phones, which they milk for billions of dollars every year. They have very expensive cell phone services. But other than that, I mean, if you think about it as a business, the Lebanese government is one of the worst businesses in the world. Anybody who's ever dealt with them. I mean, I mentioned this example in the Bitcoin Standard. They have a train authority, but there hasn't been a single train running in the country for at least 50 or 60 years. The trains got decommissioned 50, 60 years ago, and there are hundreds of employees who work in the train authority, and they still get paid. But there are no trains. And so would you invest in a business that had that? I mean, if you're thinking about buying stocks in a business or lending money to a business and you heard, yeah, and they have a train division. Oh, yeah. How many trains does their train division run? Zero. So what are they doing with that train division? No, they're just paying people salaries. Would you invest with that? No. But the beauty of the fiat system is that you don't get a choice. If you want to use banks, and you have to use banks, because if you want to trade with the rest of the world, you need to use banks. If you want to make payments, you need to use banks. If you want a credit card, you need banks. You have no choice but to keep your money in the banks. It's an essential part of a modern economy. And if there's a monopoly, you have to give your money to the banks that are in that banking system, and they're going to take and put the reserves in the central bank. And what's the central bank going to do with your reserves? It's going to buy government bonds. It's going to borrow against them, or it's going to have the government borrow against them effectively. And then when the government can't pay you back on its debt, well, then everything falls apart. When the government cannot pay back the debt, then the banks are insolvent. And then when the banks are insolvent, they are either going to give their depositors a haircut, or the other thing that the central bank can do is print a bunch of money and pay the depositors in the new devalued money. And that's what happened in Lebanon. So the government had to make its salary payments. And so they started printing money. And they printed enormous amounts of money. And the currency began to collapse. And the currency collapsed about, it went from $1 was 1,500 liras. And now it's 90,000 liras. So it's almost 99% of the collapse. And about 98% of the value of the currency has been lost. If you have money in the bank, you've lost 98% roughly.
We have a place in the United States that sounds a little bit like Lebanon. It's called California. I think they're being propped up by the fact that we have the global reserve currency, and other states are making less bad decisions in some cases. Let's shift to Bitcoin. Do you have just a couple more minutes? I know we're past the top of the hour. I want to be respectful of your time.
Yeah, that's fine.
So one thing I've heard you say before about Bitcoin is you believe the greatest threat would be a gold standard. If governments decided to become properly fiscally responsible, that's effectively it. Is that still sort of your premise? Are there other threats to Bitcoin that you see that would concern you, or you think are at least compelling sort of devil's advocate positions that people might take?
I still think fiscal and monetary responsibility would be the biggest threat to Bitcoin. I still don't think it would kill it, because I still think Bitcoin is better money than gold. So even if central banks were to go on a full gold standard and have it be better run than even the late 19th century gold standard, which wasn't perfect and had a lot of flaws, even if they do that, Bitcoin is still better money. So I think it's unlikely in my mind that gold's first mover advantage is going to make that much of a difference that it will get over the fact that Bitcoin supply increases at a much lower rate. It's already half the growth rate. Bitcoin grows at around 0.8%, whereas gold grows at around 1.8%. So therefore, I think this would be the biggest threat to Bitcoin. If I were to think of other threats, I think this whole this angle of putting garbage on the blockchain, all of that spam stuff that's being popularized, I don't think that's good for Bitcoin. I think it's extremely it's degrading Bitcoin's scaling capacity because it's using up block space for completely idiotic nonsense, which doesn't matter and is only in my mind. I think a big part of why it is being propped up is probably as an attack on Bitcoin. I think there is an angle. If I wanted to attack Bitcoin, this would be a good way to do it because you're essentially, when they conduct these spam attacks and they fill up the blocks with things, you're degrading Bitcoin's capacity and you're reducing it by about tenfold. We go from blocks having, say, 1 to 2 megabytes of data to blocks of transactions to having 0.1 blocks of four transactions. Of course, there's a lot of idiotic debates here where people say, well, you know, who are you to define that these are bad transactions? And maybe people want to use them. And why are your transactions okay, but somebody's monkey JPEGs are not okay? And the answer is, yes, I am in a position to define what is okay and what is not okay. I run a node, and it is my node, and I download the software, and I do what I want with it. And I get to decide. That's all the node does. The node is out there enforcing consensus parameters and rejecting invalid blocks, rejecting invalid transactions. That's what we do. If we didn't do that, we'd have no Bitcoin. If you didn't reject invalid transactions, there'd be no more Bitcoin. So what defines what's a valid transaction? I do. On my node, and you do on your node. And don't listen to these morons who tell you you don't get to do it because it's a network. They're a bunch of idiots. It's not a network where you are a passive member. You are under no obligation, contractual or moral, to abide by rules being given to you by other people. So it's up to you to do what you want with this. And for me, and I believe for the vast majority of people who got into Bitcoin over the last 15 years, that is money. They want Bitcoin to function as a money. They want Bitcoin to function as a payment network. And so, yes, if you put monkey JPEGs on my blocks, that is spam. And I will call you a fucking idiot. And I will treat it like it is spam. So I think it is spam. I think it is not a good thing. I don't think it's ideal for Bitcoin. But I don't think it's that big of a deal. I mean, we have spam on email. Every day I get spam emails. Every day we run, well, not every day, but it happens occasionally that emails get lost in spam filters. So spam is a problem, but it's not destroyed email. Email continues to be quite useful in spite of the vermin that spam it with garbage. And I think it's a similar situation with Bitcoin right now. We've got spammers, but Bitcoin, I think, is going to be a lot better resistant for spam in the long run than email because of the financial incentive for it. I look forward to this thing playing out because I believe strongly that everybody involved is going to get wrecked. And that's how it's going to be fixed. I think ultimately in the long run, this is going to be fixed because everybody involved in it is going to come to realize what an idiotic mistake it was in the long term to invest in these stupid things when they could have just had Bitcoin. Because ultimately block space is a shitcoin. They're always going to be making more and more block space, but they're not always making more and more Bitcoin. And so there's always going to be more garbage added onto the block space and more stupid monkeys and more stupid animal GIFs. And it's just going to continue to be added on. And your stupid nonsense is going to become less and less important. And it's just going to be part of the many, many, many garbage graffiti effectively that's on the blockchain, which, you know, might make if you're an inconsequential loser, you know, has never achieved anything in life and has never been able to produce anything for others, I guess you could get a kick out of the fact that you managed to put some garbage on people's nodes. But I hate to burst your bubble. People don't spend their day going through their node and reading what's on their node. And so your spam is never going to be read by anybody except when you go and look for it and find it, in which case you can just find it in any other place. You didn't have to pay all of the transaction fees to do that. So I don't think this is a serious threat to Bitcoin. I think it's a problem for people now in terms of transaction fees. Sometimes they go up, but I think it's, you know, on the one hand, it's limiting the scanning capacity of Bitcoin, but it's also forcing people to work on scaling solutions more aggressively. So overall, I think it'll be fine.
Yeah. No, the interesting thing for me, because that stuff frustrates me too, but I can't imagine, it's like for guys like Tony who experienced the worst of the fiat collapse, to have now found this pristine monetary asset and to be dealing with these entitled brats putting monkey JPEGs on the blockchain and spamming it. And I think you're right. It doesn't kill Bitcoin, but it's sure frustrating, you know?
It is. But I mean, the reality is the world doesn't owe you a pristine Bitcoin. You have to go out there and get it. And the world doesn't owe you cheap transactions on Bitcoin. You're out there competing with people. And some of these people are deranged, immoral idiots. Some of them are funded by intelligence agencies. And I think they're going to continue to do this as long as they have money, which I don't think will be a very, very long time, because I think this is a self-correcting problem. Ultimately, there's only 21 million Bitcoins, but there's an infinity of everything else. And so everybody's trying to spend their money attacking Bitcoin. As long as they can't make more Bitcoin, as long as they can't make more than the 21 million, then they're just going to end up with less Bitcoin, and eventually they're going to realize that they have wasted potentially.
So could you tell me, what do you think Bitcoin fixes? And then are there specific things besides human nature that you think Bitcoin doesn't really fix?
I'm not so sure that it doesn't fix human nature. I think what
incentives.
We think of as what we think of as human nature, I think a big part of it has been highly corrupted over the last century by the fact that we don't have a decent money. And in principles of economics and in the fiat standard and in the Bitcoin standard, I talk a lot about the importance of money for humans, and that it's not just a way for us to buy nice things. Money is how we can provide for our future. And the better our money is at holding on to the future, the more we are able to think of the future and the less we discount the future and the more we become future-oriented. And then the more we are future-oriented as people, then the more production we the more we prioritize the future, the more moral we are, the better we behave, the lower our time preference. Time preference is the most important thing for me, which I keep going back to. And I think the hardness of your money is like a control knob for your time preference. And so Tony will tell you stories about what happens when people's money collapses. Everybody's living hand to mouth day to day. People don't have the time to think about what they're going to be doing 10 years from now, because all of their money's gone. They have no way of providing for 10 years from now, and they need to find a way to eat tomorrow. And that's what is really pressing for people. So people become a lot more short-termist when their money collapses. And then the better the money is, the more long-term they are. And then the more long-term focused you are, the more moral you are, the more you're likely to do things for their long-term payoffs, the less likely you are to do things that pay you, that have a payoff now, but involve a heavy cost in the future. And you see this when people get into Bitcoin. You see how they changed. And it's a very common thing. People get into Bitcoin, they quit drinking, they quit doing drugs, and they start thinking about starting a family. And you see this, so many people have told me this, and I think there's a truth to it, because Bitcoin offers you a way for providing for your future, which fiat does not. And so therefore you become a lot more future-oriented, and it makes you a better person. So I think we'd be very different species if we had spent the last 100 years having a hard money that was not corrupted by governments.
Well said. All right, last question for you. What is an unpopular opinion that you hold? And bonus points if it's unpopular even amongst Bitcoiners.
Look, I have a lot of unpopular opinions, but I'm going to give you just one. Probably the most unpopular. I don't think I share that opinion with anybody. I've never met anybody who shares that opinion. But I believe that movies are a very stupid thing. All movies. I hate movies. I find the idea of sitting down and watching a movie to be so terrible for you as a person. I cannot do it. My body immediately falls asleep. It's impossible to get me to watch more than 10 minutes of a movie without falling asleep. It doesn't matter how much I slept the day before. My body just immediately says, nope, you're better off resting than listening to this garbage. I just think the idea of letting somebody In particular, you look at the kind of people that do movies. I mean, you heard about all the stories from Hollywood over the last few years. And for me, every time I hear about somebody watching a movie, in my mind, it's like letting Harvey Weinstein take a dump in your brain. It's like, here, let this guy, this completely disgusting piece of shit, this completely perverted, horrible human being, and just imagine what kind of horrific things go on in his brain. And then let me just give him 2 hours of my mind every day or once a week or three times a week and to have him just completely overload me sensorily in every way imaginable. My eyes, my ears, everything is just going to be completely overloaded with him and his mind and the things that he thought about. Why would you want to do that to yourself? I find that astonishing. And what I find really astonishing and pathetic is when people start getting angry about the Hollywood people's private lives. Like people get angry. Well, how could Kevin Spacey do this? Or how could Harvey Weinstein do that? And he must go to jail. And I just think, what kind of an idiot are you to just be aggravated about this guy doing this? And then you choose to go watch his movies. Like nobody's forcing you to watch his movies. Nobody's forcing you to let this pervert become rich by taking dumps in your brain at all times. And but people continue to do it. And I think I think in 50 years from now and 100 years from now, I think it's beginning to see it. I think we're going to look back at this fascination with movies as being just probably an unintended consequence of the fact that we invented moving pictures. And so people were just so fascinated by them. And I can sort of see the rationale in the 1940s and 50s. You lived in a small little town and everything around you was so drab and you barely got a chance to travel and you saw the same things every day. You saw the same people every day. And then you had a chance to go and sit, look at a screen and see the most beautiful people and in the most beautiful cars, in the most beautiful buildings, in the most amazing kind of setting. And it really was something that took you out of your drab surroundings for a couple of hours. And it was kind of entertaining. But now screens are so ubiquitous, they're everywhere, that you can see anything you want anytime you want. I mean, at this point, you can even generate anything you want. You can just go to an AI and tell them, I want to see this, I want to see that. So I think screens are becoming less and less captivating for us. And as a result, I think people are beginning to get bored with movies. I mean, I think just from noticing just the hype around the Oscars, I think 20 years ago, everybody was looking at the Oscars. Now nobody cares. Nobody follows. And movies are just becoming crappier and crappier. They're all just repeating the same things. And they're making remakes. And it's all just political propaganda and brainwashing. And I think it's just, I think it's really something about the medium. I don't like it and I don't recommend it.
Yeah. No, that's a good one. Not one I've heard, but I can relate. I'm like the guy who, everyone's, they reference a movie and it's like, I'm supposed to know it. And I've never seen any of the classics or anything. Like, I just don't know. Yeah. So, I can
relate.
For
me, like this is, if I'm reading something and they start referencing a movie, I'm not reading this thing. I don't care. I don't care what happened in that movie. I don't want to find out. If you can't make your point without having to reference some pervert's sick movie, then I'm just going to have to read something else. It's okay. There are plenty of people out there who are not basing their writings on movies.
Yeah, I think that's a healthy position to take. All right. Hey, Saif, thank you so much for your time. This has been an absolute pleasure. Why don't you give a handoff? You've got a lot of great things to share with the audience.
Yeah, my website, saifuddin.com. I teach courses based on my books. So you can take courses on the Bitcoin standard, the fiat standard, and principles of economics. And you can also buy the books directly. Nice hard covers. And I also have the Bitcoin Standard podcast, which is available everywhere where podcasts are available. And I'm also on Twitter. I'm pretty active on Twitter at @SaifUddin.
Terrific. Saif, thank you so much for the time. Everyone go check out his stuff. I mean, I just in the last couple of days, I recommended the Bitcoin Standard to someone and continue to do so as I meet new people who are intellectually curious enough, I think, to handle it. So thanks again for your time, Saif. We'll talk soon.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me, Michael. Take care.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.
And that's a wrap. Again, I hope you enjoyed this conversation. Saif is a wealth of knowledge when it comes to Austrian economics specifically, but is also very good at dismantling the fundamental flaws of Keynesian thought, and love his opinions on Bitcoin and agree with him generally on his final comment on movies as well. Really, really appreciate him taking the time to sit down and talk with me. Of course, if you need help with Bitcoin self-custody, there's only one way to do that properly with 100% custody. Don't share your keys with anyone else. Don't trust a third party to hold a key for you. Bitcoin only, air gap, open source, and the Bitcoin Way can walk you through this step by step and make it simple and understandable for you. So check out the Bitcoin Way at thebitcoinway.com/podcast. You can follow us on X at @thebitcoinway_. You can follow me as well there at @theothermjordan and check out my weekly Bitcoin newsletter. It's Substack, blackhatbitcoin.substack.com, and look forward to catching up again next week. Cheers.